You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
You're listening to episode number 33 of Living the Dream with Rory O'Malley. If you like the podcast, remember to subscribe, rate, and review. Or just tell your friends.
Audition, side job, swimming upstream. Believe it or not, you're living the dream.
Hello, dreamers. Rory O'Malley here. Thank you so much for listening. I have a wonderful guest this week, my very, very good friend, Danny Bernardi, who is appearing as Professor Henry Higgins, currently at the Olney Theater in Maryland. He is an awesome, awesome guy. I've known him since first week of freshman year, as we talk about in this story of me with my bad fashion choices freshman year that I've continued on in my life. Things haven't really changed much for me in that department. But luckily, I still have a friend in Danny Bernardi. He has always been there for me, and we've not always been on the same coast. I've been in Los Angeles, he's been in New York, and back and forth. But he's one of those people who will always be a part of my life and who's always kept me grounded in who I am in this business and who I started out being in this business. And I think that's so important. He's that marker for me. As so many other people from college and from that time, when I showed up to a place to study what I loved, a lot of those people knew me when I showed up and said, this is why I want to do this. And it's helpful to have them to keep me within those boundaries and the rails and remind me who I am. Danny's that kind of a guy, and I'm really proud of him. He has done an amazing job of making a career in regional theater, and with his theater company, One Year Lease, they've done some wonderful productions in New York City, and he's living life to the fullest as an actor. He's always traveling. He's always going somewhere. I really look up to him. I'm so thrilled to get to share his story with all of you. Please take a listen to my conversation with Danny Bernardi. Hi, Danny. Thanks for talking with me.
Yeah.
You're on Living the Dream with Rory O'Malley. Are you so happy?
I am. I'm happy just to talk to you, Rory.
I know. That's what the sad part is that I think I just started a podcast so I could call my friends and talk to them for a full hour.
You know, you got to carve out that time.
You do.
And,
it gets harder and harder. And then we've known each other since freshman year of college.
Oh, at Carnegie Mellon. A mere 4 years ago.
Yes, I can't believe.
Just seniors we are now.
Recent graduates. we come from different parts of the country, but
yeah.
We became friends pretty quickly. And you always say you remember me as the guy in the corduroy shorts.
Shorts, yeah, oh yeah.
Which I love when you bring up.
Oh, yeah, you love it when I bring that up. But, yeah, that was right. My first memories of us on the back of that bus, we were going to the South Side in Pittsburgh for some kind of a freshman outing, like in the first week of school. I don't even think the drama students had really met
right,
so much.
Right, because it was orientation, and you are like Mr. School Spirit. And so you were already like leading the charge for everyone to be Carnegie Mellon Tartans.
Go Tartans.
Which is our mascot, our Tartans. Like, or what
tartans,
is that?
Yeah.
It's a
textile. It's a cloth.
It's a cloth.
Right. Yeah. Cloth.
Now, this is crazy. Why is
our... No, but I mean, or it's men in skirts, I suppose. That's an idea,
well,
too.
I guess that's why we went to Carnegie Mellon.
So that was right. So it all started there at the back of that bus, and you were wearing corduroy shorts.
Right.
But I didn't talk to you about that then. You were just really nice, and we were nice to each other, and we became friends pretty much straight off the bat.
Yes.
And then later, I called you out on the shorts.
Oh yeah, and for many, many years later. But you came from San Diego. And you did theater in the children's theater there, and you went to a, where else did, isn't there like a famous children's theater there, or the performing arts high school is where you went as well, right?
Yeah, that's right. No, I mean, like, straight off the bat, my mom put me into a performing arts like school that started at preschool in kindergarten. Like, it was an art school for 8-year-olds, and so I started like doing ballet and tapping little things on the xylophone as like a little 8-year-old. But I was scared to death of getting on the stage at that point. And then on through high school, I went to the San Diego School for Creative and Performing Arts, and then a lot of my growing up really happened at San Diego Junior Theater, which you mentioned, the children's theater. That's the oldest theater, kids theater in the country. It's right in Balboa Park.
Right. And yeah. I've never seen anything that they've done, but when I was there at the Old Globe doing Comedy of Errors 2 years ago, it was like the biggest deal, you know, that everyone was showing up for what they were doing that summer. And clearly they've inspired a lot of kids.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's such an incredible organization for a lot of reasons. But one of the things that's truly outstanding about it is that the kind of the rules that we have to abide by and you know, under equity contracts and whatever our bylaws are, they get you started like as an 8-year-old. when you go and you sign in, there's the you know, 13-year-old stage manager boss is sitting there with like a red pen, and if you're late, he, you know, you get a check mark under your name, and you know, you all have to wear black backstage, and all the rules are instilled at a very young age. Right. So it's cool. Very cool place.
And San Diego itself is such a great theater town.
Right. I mean, I would love to work there.
Right.
Like, I feel like you have to move east to work west, you know, in terms of theater, you know, like to work at the bigger places, the Globe or the Playhouse. But as a kid, or as a teenager, you know, I worked at a theater called the Starlight Bowl.
Yes.
I think right now is defunct, but it's famous.
Heard of it. Yeah, well, from you and the story of what happens there is my favorite theater tradition that I've never been a part of.
Yeah,
because it's outdoors.
That's right.
And what happens,
it's a giant bowl.
And it's by the airport.
That's right. Yeah, so exactly back when the park was built for the Panama Expedition or whatever it was back in 1915, there wasn't exactly a lot of air traffic. Well, the city grew up around Balboa Park, and this theater was there and outdoors. And then pretty soon over the years, there were 737, 757s flying over. So how does an outdoor summer stock theater cope with the noise intrusion? Well, we had a system of lights that were placed above the conductor's head, and as a plane approached, the stage manager's job would be to flip on the yellow light as a warning, followed by a red light, at which point all the action on the stage stops
and you
freeze. That's right.
And freeze. Wait, so the audience doesn't see the lights, they just all of a sudden you guys freeze.
Yeah it coincides with like the apex of the roar of the engines above you, because these planes are flying like, you know, just a couple hundred feet above your head. The green light comes and you continue.
Yep. I'll never get over that. And I'll never get over the fact that I was not able to witness it. Like, if they were still around, I would do everything I could to be there on a night when a plane goes over. Were the planes going over every single show?
Every single show. And on Sunday nights, when everybody's coming home from the long weekends, there's more air traffic.
So it happened multiple times a show?
Oh, yeah. Multiple times.
My God.
It got to be a bit of a nuisance, believe it or not. Yeah.
Of course.
Can you imagine?
Of course. Like, like you're in a dramatic moment of the show. Like, like Tony and Maria, Tony's dead, Maria's monologue, and they're like, please hold. And they're frozen.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, what?
That's right. I know.
I just can't get over that is. But it's also like, to me, it's beautiful, because it's like, people will stick with you in the story.
Yeah.
You know, we always are like, how do we get people to come along with us on this journey of the story? Well, if San Diego will show up to see theater with planes flying over and pausing every 20 minutes, like, you know, I mean, that's just a testament to everybody wants to be told a good story and will hang in there.
Yeah, for the most part.
I mean, I guess it's not around anymore.
I think after a while, though, sometimes when it's, like I said, when the traffic's really crazy on a Sunday night, I think even the audience started to get a little antsy. Okay, the novelty's worn off.
Yeah.
You know, so.
Yeah.
But yeah, we did. That was a really fun place to work as a late teenager. I worked a bunch there.
And then you went to Performing Arts High School, so you were immersed in it.
Oh yeah!
Throughout your high school
years. Oh yeah, I was in our production of Dreamgirls.
Dream Girls?
You didn't know? Oh yeah, I played Marty. I played Danny Glover's role. Didn't you know that? I didn't.
I
we did colorblind casting from the beginning. That's right.
Colorblind casting. How progressive! The opposite direction.
That's right.
Yeah, wow.
That's right.
That's amazing. I mean, I just assumed you played Dave of Dave and the Sweethearts. My little role.
Yes. Yes. Well, nope.
No. No, that's great. That's great.
Yeah.
Did you do a lot of plays in high school there?
Yeah, well, you know, I guess it was mainly musicals. I did a lot of musical theater in high school, as I guess a lot of people do. We were fortunate, you know, it was the public performing arts high school. So there was a budget. You know, and we got access to like amazing sets. We had the touring set for a production of Sweeney Todd that we got to use. And so, I mean, like as a 17-year-old, I played Judge Turpin in that one. And, you know, I got to slide down the thing and get my neck cut and all that.
Yeah.
In high school, like that's pretty awesome to be able to do that then, you know?
Yeah. That's amazing. So you had a great experience in high school.
Yeah, with that.
You said, like, I want to keep pursuing this full time, and you decided to go to Carnegie Mellon. Did you audition for a bunch of different schools, and that was, like, the only thing you were going to do? Or was it, like, you know, like, that decision, especially after going to a performing arts high school to go to a conservatory, it's a pretty big one, you know? Like, did a lot of your other classmates go from high school go to conservatory-type training, or...
No, you know, I guess I don't think a lot of us did.
Yeah.
I think some of us did, but I don't know a whole lot of people who actually ended up going into conservatory.
Right.
I cast the net kind of wide. I mean, I applied to like because I loved academics too in school. So I was interested in kind of seeing where the cards fell and just kind of like, you know, see how this all goes. I did like a half and half between like conservatories and then liberal arts schools, and Carnegie Mellon worked out, and it just seemed like I had to do it. And I was pretty laser focused on performing arts at that point, as an 18-year-old, I was like, that's absolutely, there was no question for me. No question. You don't think about, oh, well, what is this decision? You know, exactly. Yeah. You're just like, well, of course I'm going to do this, you know?
Right. Right. So it's more like you wanted to do it. It was something you wanted to do and you weren't sure, you know, the right way to do it in college. But when Carnegie Mellon is like, yes, come to us, you were like, okay, great. This is,
you'll show me how,
clearly what I'm going to do. Yeah. No, I mean, that's similar to me. I just, but I was coming from, you know, an all-boys Catholic high school where
St. Ignatius.
Yeah, St. Ignatius, right. Which, you know, I could talk about for a long time. My love for my... Yeah, you're shocked.
No way.
You're shocked.
I would love that, actually. All your stories are good from St. Ignatius.
Yes.
But anyway.
But they didn't have, you know, we had a drama program, but it wasn't everything... It wasn't a performing arts high school. You know what I mean? So for me, it made a lot of sense.
Wasn't it all boys too? Like, didn't you guys have to like partner up with the girls all girls school to put on musicals?
We didn't partner up with schools. It was open to any girl who wanted to audition. So we didn't like say like we're just gonna be with this school because we were downtown. So it was kind of like, there wasn't a local, a girls, all girls school that was really close to us. But a bunch of the different all, I did a bunch of plays at the all girls school, and a bunch of the girls who were in our shows were from the all girls schools or public schools. And we had a, we had good plays. We had a great program, but it wasn't a performing arts high school. You know what I mean? Which I think if you're immersed in it all the time, and you know, I think that like after Carnegie Mellon, after we were immersed in it for 4 years, which I'm sure is a lot more than high school was, it's, I didn't want to take a class for years. For years, I was like, I don't want anyone to tell me how to act for a while because I can't deal with it. You know, like I needed to just be for work or fun, you know, and not.
Oh my God, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, what was, so we met freshman year and we were, you know, with each other throughout that whole 4 years of, you know, the crazy highs and the crazy lows, which is, it's not an easy experience going to a 4 year conservatory for acting. And you have to have friends, you have to have people who kind of help you get through it. And I certainly think of you as someone who, you're one of the reasons I survived it. And
yeah, ditto.
You know,
ditto.
It sounds dark. I loved my experience there, but
yeah,
it's really challenging.
Yeah, and also the angst of being that age at that place, far away from home, in the situation. You know, I mean, it's all of the things. I mean, it can sound dark, but it's also just that time in life. Right. I think when everything's just, the stakes seem so huge, and they are to you at that point.
Right.
You know, there's not as many years of perspective to sort of put a spin on things, you know?
Right. And you think you're in like this bubble of the most talented people you've ever met. And you think this is the center of the acting entertainment universe in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
Absolutely.
You know, and like the world doesn't get bigger than that group of people that you're with. And thank God it does. But also thank God we've been able to get each other through those 4 years. And then also the aftermath of getting out of college, which if we thought college was hard, you know, it's like you get out, you're like, oh,
that was
the easy part. You know, having a place to show up to every day and be told what to do. But your 4 years, what did you feel about your 4 years at Carnegie Mellon and being a part of?
Well, you know, you first of all, like you really talk about friends that get you through. Like you like from beginning to end, Rory O'Malley, because you know, like the way I feel about it, it was tough. It was tough in a lot of ways. You know, first of all, I'm like 18 at that point, going on 19, you know, and, but it was such a time of, you know, self-discovery in terms of just like becoming a young human person.
Right.
And then also understanding oneself as an artist or a person who wants to become a professional actor, you know, understanding what that is and nary the two shall meet, you know, right. Something that is intrinsic to me is that like, whereas our world at the Purnell Center, at least that first year was, I think we're at Margaret Morrison, you know, I like to get out. So I would jump on I was so excited to be in Pittsburgh. So I would, I would travel all over the city.
You were so excited to be in Pittsburgh.
I was. And people would like stick together and I'd be on the 61C journaling in that little triangle where the three rivers come together down there downtown. You know, I'd like, I'm going to go journal, you know, it's fall. Look, the leaves are changing. And like, I'm still very much like that. And, I didn't understand that was, it was kind of apart from our little group. Like, so I inadvertently kind of alienated myself a bit, at least when I look back. Uh-huh. And that made my first year at college just a little bit more difficult because I think I felt a little bit outside because I was interested in, you know, meeting people from other departments and other majors. And correct me if I'm wrong, but I felt like on the whole, it could be said that us are the dramats, as we were called,
right,
would kind of stick together for the most part.
Right. No, and, I mean, that's kind of sad because, you know, like you're like, I kind of separated myself from the dramats by being open to the college experience and the city that I was being put in. And I know exactly what you're talking about. You were happy to be in Pittsburgh. I was 2 hours away from home. You were a 6 hour plane ride from home. You know,
it
was, and for a lot of us, you know, Pittsburgh wasn't this destination that was new and exciting, but for you it was.
Yeah, and it was the East Coast to me. I was like, oh, I'm going to the East Coast.
Didn't get all the way there. But right. I remember you having a different experience, and that's why I say, you know, I joke that you had school spirit, but it's because a lot of us showed up to the drama school and you showed up to Carnegie Mellon University, you know? I know that that might have made you feel alienated, but I also think that you had a better experience at college because you didn't just go to be in the one department, you know? You went on to like run orientation. Right?
Right, right. Yeah, yeah, that's right. So the sophomore year, I volunteered. Yeah, I was real gung-ho about that, and, you know, I'm generally, like, pretty proud to be associated with, especially back then, I was real, real excited about, you know, the tartans and, you know, school spirit and all that. Right. I love the idea of it. So there's probably a piece of me that was... that kind of needed that liberal arts, or not liberal arts, but bigger school fix, you know?
Right.
But that, you know, that faded, you know, once freshman year was over, they kind of kicked that out of me and I settled into the sophomore year, you know, more focused kind of,
slump, depression
style. Yeah. Yeah.
They broke you down.
I was on track with all that. Yep. They did. They sure did. And I think the best thing I did in college actually was get away when I did my study abroad. That's right. because in San Diego at the School for Performing Arts, we didn't have a hardcore acting technique program. It was just kind of like we did, but I didn't take those courses. I was focused on dance and music and less on the acting classes. So I was learning everything really there.
Right.
I learned everything at Carnegie Mellon, and so it was good to get away from Carnegie Mellon and learn from the Russians. So that's what I did. I went to Moscow or Moscow, depending on whose class you're in at the time. Right?
Right.
So
you went and you studied Chekhov and Russian theater. What was that like? Did you...
It was amazing. I mean, well, go ahead.
No, I'm just, I mean, was it life-changing or was it just like a challenge?
It's the best thing I did at Carnegie Mellon was
leave Carnegie Mellon.
Was leave Carnegie Mellon. No. That sounds like bitter or something. It's actually, what I mean by that is in order to contextualize what I learned freshman and sophomore year, I had to get away from it. I was inside, like I was too deep in the forest to see the trees.
Right.
So I needed to go away and get a lot of the same techniques, Stanislavski-based stuff, Michael Chekhov, and then learn it from somebody else through an interpreter.
Right.
And then it sort of put a different angle on the things that I'd learned in at Carnegie, and made it more. It paid more dividends that way. I understood it better. You know.
Right.
So yeah. That, and I think time, you know, the time for it to sink in and all. So,
yeah. No, I mean, I think that if I have one regret about my time at Carnegie Mellon is that I didn't go study abroad because, you know, one, I think for those reasons, but also just to be able to see the world or a different part of the world for a semester is a once in a lifetime opportunity when you don't have to you know, when you're young and you can experience something, I think it gives you a perspective, not just on who you are as an actor or being creative, but to be able to just be a more worldly person.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. You know, yep. Moscow is a trip. That was, was a really cool place to do it. Cause I think Carnegie will only let you do, at the time, they would only let you go to London, and to Sydney, and then also to the Moscow Art Theater.
Right.
In Moscow. So it was a three, and I wanted to go to the non-Anglophonic one and really be immersed in something totally different. And that it was. So, yeah, I'm glad I did it. We studied in Stanislavski's house, like where he was under house arrest. Like, that's where our acting class was, you know? And, you know, I was with Ben Peltison.
Right.
You know, anyway, not to
digress. Another one of our classmates.
It was fun. That's right.
Yeah, no, I think Josh Gad went to Australia. And
oh, that's right. Oh, I forgot he went there.
Yvonne, one of our other classmates. Yeah, right. But yeah, no, I stayed because I think, I can't remember what my reasoning was, but I think it was so that I could do the musical.
probably.
You know.
Or is it, maybe it was fire codes in Russia. They weren't up to par.
No. Now, see, Danny is the one who gave me the nickname Grandma in college because I have a lot of concern about fire safety and being safe. Because when we lived together, I guess I was concerned about those things. Although it's probably because I lived there in that place for 3 years, which was condemned after we moved out, and our apartment was really, really not in good condition. But yeah, you gave me the nickname Grandma.
You had good sense. You had foresight.
Yeah.
You're wise like a grandmother. It's true. Grandma.
Okay. Well.
Anyway, moving on.
So we graduate Carnegie Mellon after 4 years, and we go out into the real world, and you know, that hits you like a ton of bricks, and you had wonderful experience and were able to move to New York City. I remember like just hearing about what an actual good experience of when you leave school at Carnegie Mellon, you go and you have showcases on the West Coast and the East Coast. And we did, and I had literally no response whatsoever. Like, I had one person. Oh, and, you know, like a lot of people in our class did really well, you know? And I think it was people like you who were having a good experience that kept my head up. You know, like if you had treated me in a different way or like been like, well, sorry, bud, you know, I think that, you know, you and Josh, who both had great responses, you really kind of got me through that period of time. And I'm just grateful for it. But what I always think about is that I had a hard time because I had no response and had no one to meet with. Right.
Yeah.
But I can't imagine being 22 and having a lot of people to meet with and having a lot of decisions to make without any real idea of what the business is and how overwhelming that would feel. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean? Like that, was that time exciting or overwhelming? And how did you choose New York? Because you ended up going to New York City.
Yeah. God, you know, that's a wild, wild time, isn't it? You know, and just stressful and emotionally just manic.
Yeah.
But it has to be said, you know, it's crazy to look back on that now, Rory O'Malley, at the showcase situation. I mean, that is like gorgeous poetic justice, right? I mean, it's just beautiful the way things have worked out for you, you know, and it's such a wonderful testament to, you never know, and it doesn't mean anything, and it should serve as an inspiration to anyone who puts all of their eggs in the basket that is showcase, you know.
Right. Which was what we're pretty much like for 4 years told that showcase is the most important part of our education. Not of the education, but like the payoff of going there is that we're going to be well connected with people, when you're done. And, you know, in many ways that is true, but it's not because of one performance at a showcase. You know, many of you had all these appointments and people that wanted to meet with you, and I had no one. I had zero people.
I remember.
In New York, especially. In L.A., I had one manager who wanted to work with me, which is why I ended up moving to L.A. without ever thinking that I would do that, is because only one person on both coasts said that they would potentially work with me.
Oh, no.
Yes. So, you know,
yes,
it was a definitely a scary time, but the reason that I was able to get through it is because of you, Josh, Gad, mm-hmm. Katie Mixon, Leslie Odom, people who were able to have responses and kind of, you know, support me through a time that was definitely really scary. But I also, like, I saw how much stress it was to have that kind of a response, you know, to have the auditions right away. I don't think I had a TV audition or an audition for a Broadway show in my first year out of school.
Right.
So I wasn't like immediately thrust into the craziness of our industry, but you were, you know, like I think that you had to deal with a lot right off the bat.
I wasn't, in many ways, was not ready for that kind of level of exposure. In some ways, how could you be? You know, like,
right.
I mean, you just kind of jump in, right? Well,
yeah.
I mean, I found that time at Showcase to be super exciting and fun to be going to different offices and meeting with different agencies and casting directors who are having generals and that kind of thing. That at that point, you know, it was easy enough to just ride the wave,
right?
You know, that the whole thing was like, yeah, of course this is happening. Like, this feels great. And then, you know, when you make the decision and sign with somebody, and how did I choose? I think what I said at the time was, I think I'd like to have my vegetables before dessert, is what I would say about New York versus Los Angeles. I think really it was just I just know theater better,
right.
And wanted to work in theater because it's, you know, home for me. And, So I think that's how I arrived at that. But signing with my first agent, you know, I remember being very timid off the bat. Like my agent at the time had to tell me, I would walk into the lobby of the office, and it's a big agency, and I was going in for routine. Back then, they printed out your sides for you.
Right.
You picked up the script in the office. Your appointment information was printed on nice letterhead. Nothing was done over email. It was all phone. Can you believe that?
That's, oh God, this is really showing
our age. That's crazy, right? No, it's crazy. It wasn't that long ago, but oh my God, it was at the same time. I remember my agent having to tell me, you know, Danny, you're a client. You can walk into the office. You know, I'd be calling. I would use the house phone, like from the lobby, to call back and say, "Hey, I'm here." And he's like, "You're a client. You can just walk in." Mm-hmm. You know, like I was very shy at the time. They felt big. And, but I had, a wonderful experience with them, and they got me a lot of interest. I met a lot of people in the industry. I'm very grateful for those years that were difficult because I was intimidated by a large agency, even though we all know and are all told, you know, they work for you. You don't work for them. Well, that's all fine and dandy, but let's talk about the market, you know,
mm-hmm.
and the reality, you know. So I wasn't quite ready to take up that much space personally, you know.
Right.
So that was difficult, but I got by, you know. Like I had a really good time growing into that, but there was a learning curve, you know?
Yeah.
If you want to talk about coping with rejection and all of those kinds of things that happened. Like,
How do you do that? Especially right when you're getting into the business, you know?
Well, there's a learning curve, and one has to be, I think, like young people that are entering at that point, this is something that needs to be addressed because, I don't think it was super healthy for me at first. I would leave Ripley Greer and like I would be so hugely crestfallen by the way I felt after the appointment. I hadn't even been rejected yet. I was just like, I'm not talking about all of them at all. I mean, I'm talking about the ones that didn't go my way, which of course are the ones that at the time I would fixate on, you know, as opposed to keeping a positive frame of mind. So I would, I remember just becoming hugely depressed and like, and not knowing what to do with all of that feeling, like banging my head against the elevator wall on the way out. Maybe not really, but maybe I did once.
Maybe once. So, I've like, definitely done that.
You know, like you're so invested. So I think what happens over time is you learn to spread your eggs out, right, into different baskets in terms of where you mine your joy and your life, you know, your so that everything, your happiness isn't dependent solely on whether or not you succeed as an actor in every single possible instance.
Right.
You know, you and I talked about that along the journey here.
Mm-hmm.
You and I talked about this, you know, years ago about the roller coaster of the emotion of auditions and callbacks and how it feels.
There's never as an actor, I feel like the most vulnerable moment is when you leave an audition and you walk from the audition room to the subway or to your car, because you've just put it all out there. You have to prepare as much as possible, but not prepare or care enough that it's everything, you know, because you, if it's everything to you, then you won't do as good of a job and they'll be able to smell it on you and it won't be good. So it's it takes a long time to find the line between between caring enough and caring too much for each individual job. And
bingo.
Well, that's
it's true.
You're doing an impression of one of our professors, Ingrid Sonnichsen, the great Ingrid.
That's right.
But one of the things I think that it was in her class our senior year, or it might have been, I know it was a guest who came to speak to us, but I think it was through Ingrid. An actor who was a working actor came and said that after every audition, when he leaves, he always throws the sides out immediately. And I think I brought this up on the podcast again, but it's something that has clearly stayed with me since I was 22, which was just the other day. He knew that there was a moment, that vulnerability of when you walk outside of an audition, which is I can't stress enough to people who are in the business or people who aren't, when you finish the sides, when you finish the scene, the audition, and you walk out of that room, it's not like they say, that was great, but no thank you, or that was great, you're hired. You walk out not knowing, and not knowing when you'll find out. And you're walking out into a room, into a waiting room with all the other people who are trying to get the same job. So I've finished auditions and walked into closets. You know, like I've been so nervous, I don't know which door to go out. And then like, if there's a bit of a maze to get back to the waiting room, that's a nightmare, because I'll just start walking around the offices and not know where to go.
Yeah, it's the worst. Oh my God.
Yeah. Like there's you, and you're just a number in that day. They'll see 100 people for that same audition. So they just, you know, want the assembly line to keep moving, and you've got to get out of there cleanly with some dignity, and it's hard. But this guy, this actor who came, he said he always throws out the piece of paper that the sides are on, that the audition scene is on, right in the audition room, so that psychologically he's like, this is done and I don't care about it anymore. I'm letting go of it. And I can't say that I've done that a bunch, but there are times where I know I need to, and that I've worked really hard on it and I've done all that I can and I need to throw it out.
Yeah.
In the recycling bin.
In the recycling bin, of course. You know, you did. You talked about this with Jason Tam.
Yes.
And I remember this because I was just listening to the podcast, and he said that he would turn them into origami swans. Right. And then set them on fire, which I just think is really funny.
That's very Jason.
You know, it's funny, but it's funny about this is that I don't remember that person that Ingrid brought in, but I happened to arrive at this very same behavior on my own. I just was like, this feels good.
Yeah.
I think it started in a passive aggressive little bit of fury. I was like, let me just, you know what? I'm going to throw these sides away. That's what I'm going to do. Like, made me feel something. But as time went on, I thought, you know, and I feel that way about, you know, scripts and stuff, like, I'd be too precious about it. Like, yeah, you just toss it away, let it go, move on. Yeah. Right. And coping, I mean, like, I don't know, like, if I was really having a moment, I would go see movies. I'd treat myself to whatever, some, like, you know, schmackeries or, like, you know, whatever. It was like, try to teach yourself gently if you're waiting for a call. I just try to stay busy, you know, work, try to do some sideline work and get, you know, like, just stay busy, go to the gym, work out, you know?
Right.
So, that's what I think in terms of coping, and 'cause there's no magic formula in any of it. Right. I mean, there's no real thing that you can, it's whatever works for you.
You mean in terms of, like, you don't have control over the situation, so you have to find a way to be okay with that, and you have to kind of just, you know, and I think that especially for us, when you go to you going to a performing arts high school, then going to a conservatory, you set up a start into the business that was a ladder, that was a clear ladder. Like, I do this, I do this.
Yeah.
And then when you get out into the real world, there's no ladder. There's no, you know, connecting the dots of one step to the next. It's constantly just trying to swing from one vine to the next. And
that's right. Yeah.
And it's easy. It's not easy to know where to swing to. And that lag time in between one vine to the next one, it's tricky.
That's right.
It's tricky.
Slippery. It's tricky.
I mean, I feel like the value of Carnegie Mellon, or being in a conservatory, or a place where you really are embedded in the trenches with a group of people your age, and then going out into the real world, the value of it isn't just the tools, it's so much the support system that we were given. Because I was in Los Angeles in our early days, and you were in New York,
right.
And we still had each other's back. And,
that's right.
You know, we were all kind of like rooming with each other on, you know, in New York and LA, and going back and forth when we had to go to, you know, an audition. I would be sleeping on a couch at somebody's place in New York. I slept on your couch or air mattress in Brooklyn, I think.
Oh my God.
One of my first visits.
Oh, the days. Oh yeah.
Remember that apartment that you guys had where they
could never afford it now. Oh yeah. Oh
yeah. But there was no, they were like, you guys had to build walls because it was a loft or something. I just remember I slept next to a big pile of lumber.
That's right. Well, because we thought, oh, well, look at this raw space. It's amazing.
Yeah, it was.
There are no walls. We'll just build the walls. So,
right.
Whoa, that was an interesting foray into, a total disaster. Right? But we did it, you know, and we each had our own room, and we didn't have any, because the sheetrock is, this apartment in Brooklyn was amazing, right? I mean, it was
Where
a corner apartment.
It was
at the time what would be referred to as like the last stop out.
Right.
So, and it was like where East Williamsburg meets Bushwick, which now would be like pretty like it's a place that's, you know, I think at the time it was fetching like, I mean, I think it was like $2,000 a month for this giant space.
Wow.
And but the ceilings were 12 feet tall, and the sheetrock was, I think, 8 feet. So we didn't think that part through. We're like, oh, so we bought all the sheetrock and we went to put it up, and we're like, it doesn't reach the ceiling. So we had kind of these giant cubicles. I don't know if we'd gotten to that part in our construction when you were there, but we essentially lived in these cubicles.
Yes, you had
so
a cubicle.
It was interesting.
I remember the cubicles, and there was just a big pile of lumber, and that I slept next to the pile of lumber.
Crazy, crazy. But I think of it fondly now, of course.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, of course. I mean, like, there's just a time, that period of time where you're trying to figure out how to live on top of the fact that you've been trying to figure out how to have a career and do all this stuff. Because we never thought about how to live when we were at school. You don't think about it. It's just like, it's not sexy or fun. So why spend any time talking about it? Right?
Right.
And I remember us having, you know, people from the Career Center at Carnegie Mellon University come talk to us, and we'd all be like, okay, you know, thanks a lot for the pamphlet, but I think, you know, I'll just stick to finding acting work. You know, I don't need this. And then you get out there and you're like, oh man, I wonder if I can call those career people at Carnegie Mellon, see if they got any leads on
transferable skills.
Yeah.
That's right.
You know, like it's living situations. Like,
sure.
You know, we had all of that information at our fingertips, and then but you don't really pay attention to it until you get out there and you
that's right.
have the potential of being homeless.
Right. Oh my God.
So you really have found a home for yourself in your career in regional theater. You have worked in so many great regional spaces, and you're in one right now, correct?
Yeah. And you know that for me, I love places. I love to go places. You know that.
Yes,
I love to
travel. You're a traveler.
That's all we did was travel as kids. So to be able to experience places in a way that's not looking from the outside in, like as a tourist, and to be engaged on a civic level where you're engaging with the community and giving back, you know, like, or you know, that there's that kind of exchange, it's super rewarding for me, you know. But I would also say that when I got almost pretty much straight out of school, about a year out is when I got my first when I got my card, and you know, I joined the union on a contract at Virginia Stage Company. So it was my first job, and I was 23, and it was on a play. And while I said I was doing musicals in high school, I majored in acting in school. So I was focusing on plays, television, and film, you know, coming out of school, not musicals as much. I booked this play, Vincent and Brixton, and shortly thereafter, I joined a theater company to which I still belong, one-year lease. And I think, you know, when we're talking about things that when we talk about coping with, you know, rejection or the difficulties of the nature of our industry, like, I think one-year lease theater company is having it as a constant and as a creative home for the past 12 years has been kind of what has gotten me through. It's the thing that's always been there. Right. And I've the friends there that I've made are family, you know?
Right.
And it goes back, you know, hooks into what you're saying about having that support network. You know, I've always got those guys, and they've always, you know, they've always got me, and I'm really, I absolutely love working with them. So that theater company to which I belong has been there this entire time, and I've grown and been able to take risks in doing sort of edgier kind of work with them, and it's been a gift, you know.
And once again, travel, because you guys go to Greece every year.
That's right.
It's been a huge part of what you do, that you guys develop work and bring it to Greece and develop work there and work with the community there. You go to the same place every year, right?
Yeah. It's a hole in the heart this year. I'm absolutely like bereft that they're there right now without me. I mean, I'm doing something super, super cool. So I'm so grateful to be where I am right now, but
you're playing Professor Higgins in My Fair Lady.
Yes. At the Olney Theater Center. It's a blast. Yeah. It's like super cool.
Right.
And, but yeah, so th- the theater company does a retreat, a creative retreat to this little village in Greece. That the year-round population is, I think, 9 or 10 people, and then it, you know, swells to about, you know, 40 or 50, and then there's a twin village about a half hour walk away where it's the big village, right. And there's about the year round population there's around 100, and it swells to about 300 in the summer. So it's not the Greece people think of when they think of Mamma Mia and all that. It's a cobblestone sort of Grimm's fairy tale looking village in the mountains that's like about half an hour from the Albanian border, and it's stunning. It's in a national park, and there's something to be said about being surrounded by beauty and nature, and having things be so totally simple to do a creative retreat. Now, we don't need to go to Greece, but the artistic director is Greek, and we started by, you know, essentially staying in our house the first year, and now the program has grown, and we have an apprentice program, and then the professional companies there as well. And now there's around 30 people that come every summer to kind of try to put it in a nutshell. And we have our own apartments and all that kind of thing. So it's a really cool deal. And the Greece part is just stuck. You know, we're there. You know, it's an amazing thing to do it in the place where it all began. And we commission new work.
Literally where theater began, you know, like,
yeah, right.
I mean, there's that part of too, which is just, gotta be, and you have been, it meant so much to you that you started learning Greek. You took, I remember you were taking Greek classes in New York City, which is so Danny.
I remember my friend Greg saying to me, okay, well, first of all, full confession, I said to Yanthi Dimos, the artistic director, I said, I think the third year in, so I've gone every year, almost, with a couple of exceptions, since 2005, and I remember, like, the second year I was there, I said to her, this is great, I don't need to learn your language. Everybody speaks English. Like, I was kind of an unabashed jerk about it. Mm-hmm. And she'll never let me forget that. She tells everybody, because now I speak it. Right. Not totally fluently, but I definitely speak it better than the average bear, and I read it and I write it, because, you know, that same summer, I think my friend Greg said, you know, Danny, I feel like such a jerk. We come here in the summers and these people are working so hard to use their English on us, and all I can do is order a coffee.
Right.
And I was like, you're right. And something kind of clicked with me, and I was like, wait, this could be fun. And I turned it in. It's like my Sudoku, you know, on the train. Like I'm pulling out, you know, my little Greek, learn Greek, you know, vocab and whatever, you know, it's a hobby for me because I like language, you know.
Right. But so. I think I think a lot of people might have that guilt about not knowing it, but not really put the effort in. I think that it speaks to who you are, that whether you're in Greece or Pittsburgh, you immerse yourself in the culture. And it's also what makes you a great actor, is because you are trying to have the different experience of humanity and the unique experience of humanity wherever you go. You know, I mean, that's the curiosity that makes someone a good actor. I think it's really important.
Thank you. That's such a nice thing to say. I appreciate that. I mean, you left me speechless. Why? Because you said something nice to me. So that's how that goes.
It's so rare that I say something nice to you, isn't it?
No. You know, I have to tell you something though, Rory. You know, in terms of the journey and all of that, I don't know how we're doing on time, but somewhere along the line, it was all kind of coming to a head for me. You remember this, because we got together at Pam's Thai. No, it wasn't Pam's Thai. It was a different Thai restaurant. One of the Thai restaurants on 9th Avenue.
One of the 1,000 Thai restaurants on 9th Avenue.
Right? Like, and I was, you know, we were, it had been, you know, we'd gotten together and I said, you know, Rora, I've had it. Like, I think I've had it. You know, it was 2010. Right. It was January. Of 2012. It doesn't matter. I guess I'm doing this more for me than for you. It was around 2012. And I said that to you. And you said to me, Danny, you know, like, you said to me, I'll never forget this. And I tell people this a lot. why don't you just let yourself be mad at the industry for a second? Just let, let yourself be mad at, just go for it. Be mad at it for a minute, just allow yourself to just kind of go there for a second and take a little break and whatever. And, you said, Danny, I know that you'd be good at a lot of things. You're interested in a lot of stuff, blah, blah, blah. Why don't you just allow yourself to just feel that for a minute and do that. And I have to tell you, I took that to heart and I said, all right, yeah, I'm going to be mad at this. And screw it. I'm going to go be a 911 operator in Los Angeles, or I'm going to go work on an oil field in Texas. And I just started spreading the net wide. I'm going to go work for the CIA. Well, right. Obviously not anymore. Then would you believe that that was a turning point for me after you and I had that conversation? Actually, now that I think about it, it was in the fall. And then about a month later, early winter, I was in my apartment in New York, and I had just kind of decided to shatter the mirror here. And I didn't have any representation at the time. I'd left my agency, and I thought, I felt sort of not sure where to turn. And out of the blue, a call comes, and it's Janet Foster, who's a favorite casting director, who was freelance when we first moved to New York.
Right.
But the call was coming from San Francisco, where you are right now, actually.
Funny.
It's full circle. And she asked me if I wanted to come in for put myself on tape for a production at ACT. And I was like, what? No, I just decided to say no to this for a minute. Right. I'm taking a break. I'm taking my power back. So I was like, okay, all right, twist my arm.
Right.
And it's the first thing I've ever booked on tape. And it's also the only thing I've ever booked on tape in terms of plays.
Right.
Sure. I still can't believe people can do that.
Yeah.
But that's beside the point. The point is, I feel like energetically something changed as a result of our conversation, you holding up the mirror to me and saying, look in the mirror, check this out, think about this, think about it this way. And I remember, I don't know if it was Ingrid who brought in that person, that same guy who told you to throw out the audition sides, but I also remember somebody saying, in relation to the thing you're talking about, caring enough but not caring too much,
right.
They kept saying, and it was so confounding to me at the time, don't care too much.
Right.
They can smell it. Okay.
Yeah.
Those things are true, but it's frustrating to hear that as a young person going into the industry because you don't know how to turn that little thing off.
Yeah.
And I still can't say exactly how to do it. So I don't know how useful this is other than speaking about my own experience
right.
And that it can happen, something I sought. But energetically, there was a change for me. And I've worked fairly regularly ever since that point. I've almost always had a job working as an actor since that time,
right.
With some exceptions of a few months here and there, but never as regularly as since that point. And so thank you. Thank you for being a friend. Thank you for being a friend.
Travel around the road and back again. Okay. I'm so happy that something I said ever made sense or
whatever.
But no, I've completely been there, and you've been there for me in that situation. So sometimes it's important to hear something from somebody you care about, a friend that you've heard a million times before, and I'm glad in that instance I was there to say the right thing. But I say it in different ways all the time that you have to be able to remember that you are more than just an actor, and you can't have just this laser beam focus on getting the job or quote unquote booking it, because
mm-hmm.
because you're going to miss out on life, and it's also going to make you not very
yeah.
good at the audition. And I don't think that I've come up with the best way to find that line of caring enough, but not too much, but it's a constant struggle and a constant, I think that's basically how to be an actor is keep pursuing that
yeah.
and, caring about the art, but not having to worry too much about feeding yourself as an actor. And that's
yeah.
it's hard. It's hard. And
yeah.
I don't think it ever it ever goes away. I think that we're constantly trying to figure it out.
I do too. I think, I don't know about you, but it helps me when I go into a room. First of all, you know that somebody said an actor prepares. Well, I think that there's something to be said. I mean, over the years, I've learned that the more prepared I feel, the more confident you feel when you walk in the room, period. Like, okay, memorize the sides, but keep the pages in your hand, if it's for theater at least, you know? But like, for me, like, that helps. Like, I try to be mostly off book if I can, which is a pain when they give you 30 pages to learn. But that helps. And then, you know, it's like any, you know, people say it's the old adage about imagining everybody's in their underwear. I mean, it's like that never worked for me, but I get the connection. It's really the same thing. You know, our Eliza Doolittle here over at the Olney Theater Center, she tells me her way. She has a little mantra that involves cuss words in her mind that she just finds a way to think of everybody as an equal collaborator on the project. Right. And that once you can actually on a heart and energetic level get to that point where you actually feel that way, like, no, I will show you who this character is.
Yeah.
Because that's what they want, right?
Right.
So if you have like a take on it, and then I think that helps a lot too. No, allow me, I will show you what this is.
Right.
You know, not as opposed to, is this right? Or whatever the other thing might be. You know, I don't know. Those kinds of things have helped me. And isn't it project by project? Some things like click with one more than others do. You know, some things you connect with more. You know, that's true for me, you know, for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, it's always on a, I've found that the further along I go in this industry, I find more and more people who are doing it and coping with it in a way that is a model for me that I will want to like, be like, they figured something out. Either it's an ease with it or a certain focus, or, you know, their attitude, and I can learn from them. It's not usually like an acting style or a creative thing. It's about how they live the dream. Hey, and I even got a ding on that one.
That's right. You did right then. You did. Let's go play the lottery.
I really am so, so grateful that I got to talk with you. I love you.
Yeah, you know, I love you too.
You're one of my best friends, and you've given so much to me. You know, we've had these conversations over the years, and I'm really appreciative that you would sit down and talk with me so that we could give it to some other people and hopefully some friends who are at a conservatory right now or just got out, who are building their walls in Brooklyn. or further Wait, out now that they've
been recording this.
You've been recording this. Sorry, forgot to tell you. I love you.
I hope so too.
I'm so proud of you, and I'm just really grateful for all that you've given to me as an actor and a friend. So
ditto. I hope to see you soon.
Yes,
and it's great talking to you.
Come home to California.
I will.
Okay, good.
I will be there soon.
Good. All right, bud. Love you.
All right. Thanks. Talk to you soon. Love you. Bye. Bye.
Audition, side job, swimming upstream. Believe it or not, you're living the dream.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway, and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com.
If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.